This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Here.
I did. What's it to you?
Where are you from, stranger?
Nowhere nice.
Got a name?
Hell. Sam Hell.
Roddy Piper is a nomad traveling the post-apocalyptic countryside, leaving a wake of pregnant women behind him as he encounters a horde of mutant amphibians. In Hell Comes to Frogtown, a 1988 film directed by one Donald G. Jackson. And that's the topic this week on episode 30 of Go Home in a Box, right here on the Place to Be Nation Pop Network. Directors who are off the beaten path. We're going to talk about a couple. Mr. Jackson is one. We'll be talking about a second film, The Duel, from the great martial arts film director Chang Che. But we'll cover Hell Comes to Frogtown first. But before we get to that, I am Chris Jordan, one of your grateful co-hosts, and the proprietor of RetroMovieNerd.com. And with me, as always, is my co-host, the Ayatollah of Pop Cultura, as he has not been known in for a while, because we've been on a bit of a break. Joel LaPuma, how you doing, man?
Hey, I'm doing good. How you doing?
Hey, great to be back, man. Gosh, we had a bit of a break there. We had some stuff that we needed to take care of, and the holidays and everything. We just decided to just call it a break for a few weeks to take care of some stuff, and glad to be back, man. Glad to hear you, man.
Oh, same here, dude. Yeah, no, I've been claiming it's family stuff, but it's pretty much just been Friday the 13th on PS4.
Yes, we took a hiatus so you could try and beat the machine.
No, I've done pretty well for myself. I've successfully worked alongside mostly what seems to be a gamer base of mostly squeaky voice teenagers.
Yeah, well, I'm not much of a gamer myself, but that's how I picture that whole scene to be, is, you know, just a bunch of, guys just, you know, reaching puberty and trying to, you know, whisk through Call of Duty.
What I expect for, like, Call of Duty or, like, an FPS like that. But, you know, Friday the 13th, I kind of expected a bit of an older player base like me, like people who've grown up with the movies, but it seems to be young kids who have been asking me, so what are the movies really like? Like, they've seen clips on YouTube, but somehow yeah. Haven't seen the full movies yet.
Well, that's awesome, man. You can be the kindly old grandfather of the group who sits them around campfires and tell them stories about Jason Voorhees. And
I could be like the camp director in Mad Men.
Yes, you can. Yeah. Or John Houseman in The Fog. you have to do his voice, though.
Oh, if only I could.
So, regardless of all that, it's great to be back. Glad y'all could join us and listen in. We're going to talk about a couple of, pretty fun movies here in just a moment. Well, let's get to our usual segment of new releases. I know we've been away a while. A bunch of stuff has come out, but we're not going to cover that. You can just go Google it, you know. That's too much ground for us to cover because the Christmas rush had a lot of stuff coming out. But we're going to cover new releases for this coming week, the week of January 9th is typically new release day. And we've got a couple of interesting selections here. The first one I just want to touch on real quick from Code Red is a release of the 1976 Jack Palance film, Black Cobra Woman, what is also known as Emmanuel and the Deadly Black Cobra. I think this, I'm not sure if this is an official entry in the famed Emmanuel franchise, Joel, but it definitely is one that's kind of rare and one of those forgotten gems that Code Red has brought back. And it's out on Blu-ray this week. Well, here's one you're interested in, Joel, from Arrow. They're putting out Volume 1 of Seijun Suzuki, The Early Years. You probably have a few details on this one that you want to share.
Yeah, all of these, it's their first appearance on any sort of home format outside of Japan, actually. Suzuki had a long and, you know, very prolific career. He's best known for Yakuza films, but his early stuff, a lot, even though there might be some Yakuza elements here, most of it's kind of like youth revolt films. Sort of lost, aimless, angry, drifting youth films, which Japan does better than anyone except maybe America. Well, the UK had some good ones too during the kitchen sink drama days, but these haven't seen any of them yet, of course. But Suzuki, he's an incredibly like raw and energetic filmmaker. He's a perfect fit for this kind of filmmaking, and his stuff is always incredibly like vital and interesting and weird and energetic. I mean, some of his stuff just is so strangely filmed with such purpose that it's like an entirely new film language. The stuff like Branded Killer, Tokyo Drifter, but you know, early on, like I expect these to be a bit more normal as he finds his style and voice. But I mean, they're probably going to be a little weirder than your typical like youth revolt films.
Yeah, I've of course I've only heard of Seijun Suzuki in passing. I haven't really personally checked out any of his films, but this is probably a good place to start for those who are trying to maybe delve into some foreign cinema, especially Japanese cinema, which just has a rich history that doesn't really get a whole lot of mainstream coverage, really.
No, I mean, you know, if it's something digestible for people like Godzilla or, you know, some of Kurosawa's stuff, like people have some familiarity with it. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of brilliant Japanese film out there as one of the strongest cinematic traditions of any country. It's just, there's just absolutely amazing stuff being done there for decades. And the, you know, 60s and 70s in particular are really, really packed years for them. So the 50s too, but when we're talking about like that sort of new era, like new wave of Japanese film, like Suzuki's stuff in the 60s and 70s is what we're talking about.
Yeah. All right. Very good. So Seijun Suzuki, The Early Years, Volume 1 from Arrow Video, coming out this week, January the 9th. Probably the mainstream release of the week, Universal, is putting out, re-releasing on Blu-ray with all new artwork and all that fancy stuff. It's Jurassic Park, Lost World Jurassic Park, and Jurassic Park 3. Probably because we got a new Jurassic Park movie coming out later this year. And so, you know, now's a good time to cash in, Joel. And we know that, you know, these releases from Universal and Paramount and all these big companies, it's always about the cash.
Oh, yeah, you gotta cash in. Just rebuy everything you bought ages ago.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, but you don't have Jurassic Park with this fancy new cover. And you can take the old one to like Half Price Books and get like maybe a dollar back for it while they put it on the shelf and charge like $9 for it. So.
Yeah, you know, the trade into FYE or something. You can get Malibu Stacy with the new hat.
Yeah. Or just the hat.
Just, you can't get the hat separately.
It's the accessory collection. We got a couple of other interesting releases here on DVD. I could not see if these were on Blu-ray as well, but on DVD we've got from 1980 a Fred Olin Ray film, The Alien Dead, from Bayview Entertainment. This is another, of course, Fred Olin Ray, a famed cult film director. Not to touch on, go too deep on Fred Olin Ray, but you know, The Alien Dead is probably not one of his better known films, but it's got from the old Flash Gordon serials, Buster Crabb is in this one.
And Buster Crabb is actually the only actor that's ever played Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers, and Tarzan.
Yeah. So
obviously this is late in his life. I think he died a few years after this, but
and of course Fred Olin Ray was a big, you know, Buster Crabb fan, and that's the only reason why Buster Crabb is in this film, because Fred Olin Ray wanted to give him a job and work with him. So it worked out, because The Alien Dead gets a DVD release, so someone's getting paid for it. And also coming out from 1978 on DVD, we've got a movie called The Alien Factor. This is basically your typical late 70s sci-fi in the post-Star Wars mania, low-budget film, basically about an intergalactic spaceship carrying species of different kinds, different races from different planets, crash-landing on Earth, and all hell breaking loose as these specimens run around in the middle of buttfuck USA, terrorizing everything. And this was directed by Don Doler, who actually has another film that some people may have heard of under his belt called The Galaxy Invader, which I believe has been riffed. I can't remember if it was the Riff Trax crew who did it or MST3K did The Galaxy Invader, but regardless, Don Doler directed that film as well. So this is another one worth noting. It's the 40th anniversary edition. So, you know, expect just The Alien Factor on DVD. I don't think there's anything else included in this 40th anniversary edition.
I sincerely doubt it. I mean, Doler is an interesting figure because his best claim to fame is probably in publishing. He started a magazine called Wild, a very Mad Magazine kind of work that had contributors, major underground comic contributors, Jay Lynch, Art Spiegelman, who people probably know from Mao's, Skip Williamson. Like, he came up with Cinemagic magazine, which was like a special effects based film magazine that had sort of step by step tutorials. And like, it inspired a lot of, it inspired a lot of like young filmmakers during its time. Like, he's got a really interesting history in fan circles. I haven't seen his films, so I don't know like how much that might translate to his own films. I imagine they're probably just absolute schlock, but
yeah, that's pretty much it in a nutshell. You know, it's typical in terms of The Alien Factor. It's, you know, your typical late 70s, you know, drive-in fare, you know, midnight movie showings. So, but it has some stock in the cult film circle. I know that I have a Mill Creek, like, 50 movie collection with The Alien Factor on it. Those things were not remastered before they put them on this set, so everything is, like, very poor copies, but this should be a cleaned up copy of the other factor. We'll hope anyway, since it's the 40th anniversary edition, you'd think you'd give it a wipe or two, you know?
See, and Doler, like, film-wise, I think the film of his I'm most familiar with is Night Beast. I think mostly because Troma distributed that, and I think, like, teenage J.J. Abrams worked on it or something ridiculous like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, so there's a little bit of a cool factor in there. You know, Don Doler worked with J.J. Abrams, so, you know, check out the Alien factor because of that.
So if you want to see what inspired the new Star Wars films, clearly the Alien factor was it.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way, you know what, that's why I bring you along, Joel, because you have insight just like that. And with that insight, let's talk about this anthology film from 1967 coming out on Blu-ray called The Witches. This isn't your 1990 Angelica Houston, The Witches. This is this is probably something a little bit more arty.
Yeah, there's a lot of films out there called The Witches, actually. But this one is what I wasn't familiar with until reading about the upcoming release. It's an anthology film. Dino De Laurentiis put this together. And it's five different directors, five segments, and, like, the talent behind it is really ridiculous. Like, so much so I can't believe this film has gone fairly unnoticed, because it's got Vittorio De Sica, director of The Bicycle Thieves, you know, Pier Paolo Pasolini, who did Salo, The 120 Days of Sodom, Lucino Visconti, who directed The Leopard and a million other films. I mean, just major, major directors in film history, let alone, like, you know, beyond what we usually talk about in terms of, like, our usual cult stuff. Like, you know, the kind of directors who regularly make, like, the sight and sound greatest films of all time list, that kind of thing. So it's a pretty remarkable little anthology piece, kind of similar to Trilogy of Terror, in that every segment stars the same lead actress, Silvana Mangiano, who I don't know terribly much about her work. I mean, she was fairly big in Italy for a good period of time. Most people probably know her from Dune later in her career. She was like a pageant queen and model, became an actress through that. I mostly know her from the Italian film Bitter Rice, which Criterion put out sometime last year, if I remember correctly. But she's, you know, long and fairly prolific career, and of course she was married to De Laurentiis for, you know, something like 30 years.
Ah, okay, yeah. And I believe one of these films has, you know, as in terms of notable names, Clint Eastwood is in one of these segments.
Oh, yeah, it's an Italian film in the 60s. Clint had to show up somewhere.
Yeah. This is another interesting one in terms of, you know, if you're looking for something that's not exactly mainstream, maybe you're a foreign film buff, this is definitely one that you probably want to check out then. With that said, we've got another major release coming out on Blu-ray this week, and this is one that we actually talked about on Go Home in a Box. This is the time for Stephen King's It to be released on Blu-ray. I know this has probably been anticipated by some people who have not seen it yet. But we reviewed it ourselves. We both quite enjoyed it, maybe even more so than the original miniseries.
Yeah, I mean, aside from there's plenty I like about the original miniseries. Of course, obviously Tim Curry's performance is iconic, and there's a lot of great things about it. But I think this is just exactly what I wanted out of an It like adaptation. You know, tightens the story, like the cast, the young cast is just absolutely phenomenal. The direction, cinematography are beautiful. It's an excellent coming of age film. It's a good horror film. I think there's some horror sequences that maybe get a bit repetitive or lacking because it follows that very sort of mainstream structure of great build up, but then boom, jump in your face, scary thing. You know, if you've seen Insidious or The Conjuring, like any James Wan horror film, it does like adhere to that style a bit too much. But in terms of cast and character and like accuracy of coming of age feel, it really is a remarkable little film. Now, of course, it's going to be out everywhere, but I noticed there's an exclusive Target release with like, you know, some dairy postcards and like a lenticular cover, which, you know, I'm probably going to pick this up at Target just so I can, you know, hold up the cover and have the watch
extra,
it change.
Yeah, I have the extra goodies, man.
So I don't know if it's going to be more expensive. So if you're worried about that, maybe just buy it off, you know, a DVD website of some sort. Buy off Amazon, buy it off, I don't know, if Diabolik DVD is going to have it in. Might be a bit too mainstream for their catalog. But, you know, I don't know if it's going to be cheaper at Target is what I'm saying.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, but it's definitely going to be a good seller for sure, since, like we said, it was highly anticipated on its theatrical release. And there's still a segment of people, you know, there's people who enjoyed it and want to own it, and then there's people who haven't actually seen it yet. So, this is going to be a good seller for sure. Be watching for that. All right, and there's your new releases for this coming week. January the 9th. Check them out. Find them online. Find them in a local store. Whatever you can. There's some good ones out there. And they're just waiting for you to pick them up and enjoy. Onward and upward we go, Joel. It's time to talk about our movies. Like I said, we've got two movies to discuss this week. We wanted to talk about a couple of directors that were kind of off the beaten path a little bit. You know, maybe they're a little bit more well-known in cult circles rather than mainstream circles. The first one we wanted to talk about was Mr. Donald G. Jackson, the director of our first film, Hell Comes to Frogtown. And we'll talk about Jackson himself here for a moment because it's kind of interesting, the story behind him. You know, he's, there's certain circles of the media that in the past have referred to him as like the, Ed Wood of the video age, like, you know, in the VHS era. He put out some pretty bad films. You know, basically it was due to, the bizarre content and lack of any defined, storyline in his films, and mainly because virtually all of his films were harshly criticized. So therefore he got the moniker the Ed Wood of the video age. You know, in the mid-70s, he made his first feature film, a horror film parody called The Demon Lover. And then from there on, he kind of got his feet wet with that, and he finally moved out to Hollywood and started making some pretty bad movies. you know, throughout his career, he worked with guys like Roger Corman, who himself, although more successful than Jackson, Roger Corman was also known as, you know, king of the B movies. Sometimes B stands for bad. Not always, but in some cases. He also worked with James Cameron a little bit. But it wasn't until he began, like, a collaboration with a guy by the name of Scott Shaw that they created something called Zen filmmaking. Zen filmmaking basically is like a distinct style where there are no scripts used in the creation of the film. They just wing it, man. Just Zen filmmaking is like, it's kind of like throwing stuff at a wall, not even seeing what sticks, just throwing it at the wall and filming that. And so it led to quite a few movies. Probably one that a lot of people know, especially if you're a fan of cult films. He did. He was the man behind the Rollerblade 7 movies. We got like Rollerblade 7, Legend of the Rollerblade 7, Return of the Rollerblade 7. Yeah, he's a big fan throwing people on rollerblades and just letting them do whatever comes naturally, I guess.
Yeah. Now, one of the things, speaking of the rollerblade obsession, that qualifies Jackson for the Ed Wood of the video age is that his obsessions are right out in the open. So there is a preponderance of rollerblades in his films. We don't know why. Just like there's a preponderance of frogs in his films, and we're not entirely sure why. I mean, that one, you could probably fairly charitably chalk it up to the success of Hell Comes to Frogtown, because it was a fairly successful, you know, cult release, mostly due to Roddy Piper, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But the rollerblade thing, we're not entirely sure. I should also mention that there's a really fascinating early documentary about Dial Jackson when making Demon Lover, called Demon Lover Diary. It's a little hard to get hold of, but it's absolutely worth it if you can find it online. It pops up occasionally. Made by Joel DeMott, who later became a fairly renowned and accomplished documentary filmmaker for films like 17, which is also just astonishingly good, by the way. But DeMott helped Jackson film Demon Lover, and it's insane. There's a point at which they end up at Ted Nugent's house to get guns and explosives.
Where else are you going to find guns and explosives but at Ted Nugent's house?
I mean, to be fair, like, that would be my, like, if I was going absolutely stream of consciousness, that would be my answer. But it's just batshit insane.
Right.
So Jackson is not only, like, that's another reason why the Ed Wood of the video age moniker is not, like, just, you know, just branding or window dressing or anything. Like, he's certifiably insane and will do whatever it takes to get a film done, which makes it even weirder that he also has this sort of competing philosophy of Zen filmmaking. Like, it just, none of it actually matches up. I mean, Hell Comes to Frogtown is not a real great example of the Zen filmmaking idea, because for whatever it's worth, it is clearly, like, a structured film.
Yes.
And that's partly due to, I'm sure it was intended to be, like, a money-making venture. I mean, why else would you get, like, Roddy Piper in the late 80s?
Exactly. And that's the reason why we want to talk about that film, mainly because of Piper's involvement. And but looking at that, you discover why, you know, Donald Jackson had the reputation that he had, as you delve a little bit deeper. I mean, look, just on title alone, I mean, we can't forget that there was that, other than, like, the Rollerblade 7 and Legend of and Return of and whatnot, he also had Rollerblade and Rollerblade Warriors, Taken by Force. There was Roller Gator in the mid-90s. There was that obsession with rollerblades for some reason. Yeah, I wish we could talk to him, but unfortunately he's passed away. But we had other types of titles of his. We had, like, The Devil's Pet, Pocket Ninjas. That sounds interesting. I don't know. That might be. That kind of sounds like a cross between Three Ninjas and The Borrowers or something. I don't know.
I'd watch it.
Baby Ghost from 1995. There was Lingerie Kickboxer in 98. We got, and it seems to be he revisited the reptilian realm as well with movies like, we mentioned Roller Gator already, but there was also Toad Warrior in 1996. And
you know, Roller Gator may be the ultimate Donald Jackson movie, because it's got the rollerblades and frogs aren't reptiles, but
he thought, why am I wasting my time making one movie for each topic when I can just combine the two and I can have rollerblading alligators?
And not only that, but it's also got Joe Estevez and Conrad Brooks, so it's it's sort of the ultimate B movie.
Yeah. So yeah. So Donald Jackson, you know, kind of a prolific career in the B movie realm, and in his case, B does stand for bad for the most part. But you know, definitely a cult film director. Actually, you know, has his fans. Well, let's talk about Hell Comes to Frogtown a little bit, because this one actually, like we mentioned, this one actually has some structure to it. It actually has a screenplay. Donald Jackson actually wrote the screenplay with a guy by the name of Randall Frakes. And, you know, Randall Frakes, in terms of screenwriting, a little bit of a small Hollywood career. He helped write the screenplay for Jackson's Rollerblade in 1986. There was this one, Hell Comes to Frogtown. He also wrote the screenplay for Rollerblade Warriors Taken by Force. You know, he wrote the novelized version of Terminator 2, Judgment Day. You know, when I don't know what the case is now, but back in the day when a big, you know, budget movie came out, you would get the paperback version of the story. Sometimes it'd be slightly different than what you got on screen. The co-writer for Hell Comes to Frogtown, Randall Frakes, wrote the novelization of Terminator 2.
Yeah, he's got an interesting career behind him as well. You know, he was sort of in that Roger Corman circle and James Cameron circle, because he also did the novelization for the original Terminator as well, and he worked on Battle Beyond the Stars and Galaxy of Terror and Escape from New York, so he did some work on the music for Aliens, I think, or the sound effects, so he was in that sort of B-movie turned blockbuster creator's circle that Corman and Cameron occupied around the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
And was an investigative journalist and, you know, wrote for a ton of fan magazines like Analog and Fantasy and Science Fiction. I mean, you know, really interesting career. Never seemed to, like, really do anything, like, as significant as, obviously, some of the people he worked with, but just sort of fascinatingly on the outskirts of that the entire time.
Yeah. Well, I guess he had friends in the business that kept him, you know, they gave him jobs from time to time. So yeah, he's another guy that probably, you know, has a bit of an interesting background behind him. Well, let's take a look at Hell Comes to Frogtown. We'll take a look at the cast a little bit. Of course, Roddy Piper. We all know who he is. He plays a guy by the name of Sam Hell in this movie, which is, well, of course, it seems to fit. We got Sandahl Bergman as her character's name in this one is Spangle. And, you know, we all know Sandahl Bergman from Conan the Barbarian as Conan's love interest in that film, who got killed with the snake arrow.
She bravely sacrificed herself, Valeria. No, Sandahl, she's cool. I mean, you know, professional dancer, worked with Bob Fosse, you know, was a dancer in Pippin, worked on all that jazz. I mean, you know, another person with a really weird, sort of fascinatingly, you know, all over the place career. And, you know, because she's incredibly, I mean, she's legitimately 6 foot tall. Like, she sort of, and has that, you know, she's, you know, incredibly strong from being a professional dancer. She's got that very statuesque look. Like, you know, she became sort of a perfect, like, female lead for, like, the sword and sorcery stuff that was happening in the 80s, but when that dried up, there wasn't really, like, a lot of places for her.
Yeah, and in this movie, she plays a she plays a nurse. I guess the government is run by an organization of like warrior nurses, and she plays one of the lead nurses, and I guess they gave her big, huge, giant Coke bottle glasses in this one. Yeah, definitely the 80s fashion sense is prevalent in this one in terms of eyewear, anyway, in her case. So then we have, I guess it's pronounced Cece Burrell is in this. She's mostly known for being on TV. She's had roles in TV shows like L.A. Law, Hunter, Cheers. She was in an episode of Cheers, an episode of Matlock. So I mean, she was off and on, like a lot of like minor roles, one-off roles in television. But in here, she plays her character's name is Sentinella, and she's kind of the tomboyish character in this film. Like we said, there are a group of warrior nurses in this movie, and she fits the bill pretty good. Here's one of our favorites, Joel. William Smith as Captain Devlin, or Count Sodom. And, of course, William Smith is a prolific B-movie actor. He's been in all kinds of cult films from the 70s on through. He's still appearing in films off and on at this time.
And Smith, of course, worked with Jackson a lot, and like was in all of the major Rollerblade 7 films. I mean, yeah, at this point, he was in so many post-apocalyptic films in the 80s.
Oh, just... he was. And I'm sure he was glad to be in all of them, too.
But, you know, we've seen... You might know him from Invasion of the B-Girls, which is a personal favorite of mine.
Yeah.
From a Fred Williamson film that starts with Boss that I can't repeat here.
And I remember him as the villain in Gary Busey's I Have the Tiger.
Yes, yes. Yeah, he was in Bigfoot. He was in Conan the Barbarian. He was in The Outsiders, Red Dawn. He was around a lot of places in the
80s. Oh yeah, he was another prolific career from someone involved in this movie here, because it doesn't even necessarily have to be a low budget film. You've got yourself like he generally appeared in these like action type films, action sci-fi type movies, and but he was called upon quite often. He kept himself quite busy mostly throughout the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, I mean, it really sort of remarkably versatile cast here. We've got Rory Calhoun in here.
Rory Calhoun, yeah, he plays his character's name is Looney Tunes. And so Rory Calhoun, this guy, oh man, a lot of films from like the 40s through the early 90s. He was quite often a lot of westerns, a lot of TV. That episode of The Simpsons, 2001 Greyhounds, yeah, where Mr. Burns says one of the puppies is standing on his hind legs looking like a little Rory Calhoun.
And that's actually where I learned who Rory Calhoun was. But, I mean, of course, if you were working in Hollywood in the 40s and 50s, you were in a bunch of westerns, and of course he was. He probably best known for starring in the Texan, which was a CBS Western in the era where like there were tons of westernings on TV.
Yeah, oh yeah, that was the TV du jour back in the 50s and 60s with westerns. So we've got quite a decent cast here. Well, let's talk about the plot of Hell Comes to Frogtown a little bit. Of course, the setting is a post-apocalyptic wasteland. We got very few fertile men and women exist because of the atomic fallout. As a result of that, the government places a high priority on those that can still breed. And we also have a group of mutant amphibians. And some of them look like frogs. I think they're various amphibians. But the humans have exiled them to the desert. But they've captured a group of fertile women, and they plan on using them as sex slaves. So we already have the misogynistic themes rolling through. And of course, Roddy Piper is Sam Hell. And the warrior nurses, the nurse organization, are able to track him. They wanted to track him down because they want to use they want to use his bodily fluids to impregnate women. And they're able to track him because apparently he's already left a slew of them in his wake, no matter where he's been. So basically, you know, we have the theme here of women being used as you know, breeders or anything. So yeah, this is not a movie that ages too well. I guess you can say that anyway. But yeah, they capture Sam Hell, they capture Roddy Piper, and they just want to use him as breeding stock. And he thinks he's going to have he's all excited because he thinks he's going to have sex with a bunch of women, but actually they just want to extract all the stuff from him.
Which I guess makes sense in terms of consistency in pregnancy, but yeah, it's a film where you're never really sure whether it's trying to be satirical.
Like, right? Exactly. It could be satirical, but then there's times in the movie where it's like, nah, this thing's just got us thinking all wrong.
Yeah, it's really hard to pin down what it's actually like saying or trying to say, and that might be, it's not one of Jackson's Zen filmmaking movies, but it's still a Jackson film. So, I mean, if I had to pin it down, considering Jackson's like, you know, long history working with, and of course Randall Freight's, their long history working in like the sci-fi fan realm. There's part of me that thinks this might be a parody on some level of like a lot of others, like science fiction post-apocalyptic stories.
Right. Yeah. And so you move along with this. So we've got the nurses wanting to recover the captured women. And they kind of blackmail Sam Hell into doing it for them, sending him out into the desert to try and rescue the women. And the thing is, to make sure that that he follows their orders, they have to put a big old electronic codpiece around his loins that'll explode if he disobeys or tries to escape. And so that big clunky metal thing, around his crotch is prevalent throughout the movie.
I'm actually surprised this film hasn't gotten picked up by Reddit. I feel like those sad little snowflakes complaining about women wanting to be treated like human beings would be using this as a metaphor constantly. But who knows?
Oh yeah, you know, so Sam Hell, Piper, he's constantly under threat of having his crotch blown off if he doesn't follow orders. So we got that. We got a little bit of an interesting plot development going on there. He's actually deemed expendable anyway because I've already taken numerous samples from him. So I mean, he really doesn't have anything to gain or lose. By not following orders. But they don't send him out alone. He gets paired with, of course, Spangle, Sandahl Bergman, and the aggressive Cece Burrell, Sentinella. And off they go in their truck out in the desert to try and confront the... They're sending out to Frog Town. And that's actually a derogatory term that they use to describe where they've banned the amphibians too. Of course, you know, Piper, you know, tries to escape a few times, but he learns pretty quick that Spangle will shock his genitals if he gets too far away. And so this is like a running gag throughout the movie with this you know, explosive codpiece that that the Piper has to wear. So at this point, we got a little bit of comedy in the plot with this gag and of course the sci-fi element. So this thing, and you know, there is a little bit of misogyny, not a little bit, there is quite a bit, because I misspoke a little bit there. So this basically is, I mean, the film is not dull. It's not uninteresting. There's plenty of stuff going on. There's plenty to point at and laugh as well. So,
you know, it's a case where it doesn't move as fast as I wish it did, and it doesn't have as many fight scenes as I wish it did, but obviously having Piper there is a huge help, because he's like, with his terrible material, he manages to make it amusing. He's naturally funny. He's self-effacing enough to let you know he's in on the joke. I mean, the stupid running gag with the codpiece works so much better when you've got like Piper's like crazy eyes selling like how terrified he is of getting it, of setting this thing off.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's actually, this movie predates They Live by almost a year or so. You could say that this was, Piper's first, starring role. And he's surprisingly effective. Of course, he would get better in They Live. So, and Piper proves himself to be, you know, a quite adequate leading man, especially on the B movie level, where the demand for, I guess, for a big time action star is a little less expected. Like, if you're going into a movie called Hell Comes to Frogtown, you know your expectations are lowered. And Piper works on that level as a leading man, because whereas he's not, you know, like a great actor, his background in wrestling throughout the years, I think, really helped him, in this movie, just, you know, get everything over, get the storyline over,
The fight at the end, I mean, it's, without Piper, it would be true, like, 60s Star Trek level, a guy in a desert, like, wrestling around with a rubber mask dude. But when you see, like, you know, Piper's got, like, the blood on his teeth, his teeth are all gritted, and his eyes are wild, and he's, like, really struggling. I mean, having a wrestler in these movies is something I'm surprised didn't happen more often, because when you need like that, that's why I think there should have been more fight scenes in this film, because like when Piper has to sell being exhausted and desperate, like it absolutely hits like great action movie moments. Like that scene should be ridiculous, but you're right there with Piper because you can see his face and how much he's selling that, like, this is his last chance to like save everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing. So, you know, so Roddy Piper is probably the best thing about this movie. But the other thing I wanted to mention was, even though we have ourselves a B movie here and a low budget, I did actually think that the makeup and the costumes, the effects surrounding the amphibians, the mutant amphibians, it actually was a lot better than I was expecting. Like, I went in with low expectations, and that actually, you know, surprised me. It actually worked for me on that level. It wasn't horrible, asylum level CGI. It was, costumes, makeup, practical stuff, and it actually, was better than I was expecting it to be.
Oh no, I was impressed too, partly because, for a lot of the major frog characters, they had actors and actresses with really like with voices that had a lot of presence or distinctiveness to it, so like it sold them as like
characters or, you know, sold them as presences in the film. And the makeup's pretty solid. Like, it, you know, obviously, you know, you're looking at like rubber masked people, but like, you know, the makeup is adequately, like, you know, it moves pretty all right for this era. Like, the facial movements are pretty spot on for that kind of mask in this era. Like, you know, they're textured well. They're, like, adequately sort of slimy looking. And there's a lot of great details. Like, I love when they first get to Frogtown. They're in that bar, and there's, like, this weird Casablanca riff with he's trying to trade with the guy wearing a fez and a white suit. Like they're in a Moroccan bar or something. They're not just content with, like, frog masks. Like, the frogs are wearing eye patches. There's the female, like, you know, rebellious frog operative that helps out Roddy and also tries to aggressively sleep with Roddy. Exactly. Who's got, like, you know, she's wearing like eyeshadow. Like, she's wearing, like, you know, a woman's hat. She looks kind of like if B. Arthur were a frog.
Shit. It reminded me of that one gremlin in Gremlins 2.
Yes.
I don't want to get into Gremlins 2, but I just had to mention that.
No, exactly. So, like, the frogs, like, I think that helps. Like, not only is the makeup pretty solid, but, like, the costuming, like, every frog character sort of has their own style and distinct, like, quirk. And that really helps sell them as just, like, instead of a bunch of, like, masked creatures, these are actual people, in a sense. And it's much more clever than I honestly would have expected from Jackson.
Yeah. And one of the character Bull, the elite frog, Nicholas Wirth played him. Nicholas Wirth has done, you know, a lot of stuff. He mainly played, like, henchmen and tough guys, you know, in movies like Swamp Thing and Action Jackson. He was in Dark Man. But he also, and you talked about voice work, but he also did some video game voice work. He did voice work in the game Command and Conquer, or in the series Command and Conquer. He was in the game called The Beast Within, A Gabriel Knight Mystery, Emperor, Battle for Dune. And he also voice acted as Colonel Bulba in the game Freedom Fighters.
Which is actually one of my sort of favorite little underrated PS2 era games. I played that a lot back in high school, which was basically like EA doing Red Dawn, the video game.
Yeah, so Nicholas Wirth, the actor who played the character Bull, yeah, voice worked in that game. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's an interesting, got an interesting career behind him himself, because he's got that very strong, deep bass voice. And most people listening probably know him best from Don't Answer the Phone, where he was a serial killer. It made use of his, you know, creepy, deep voice. And I haven't seen this, but a fairly infamous TV movie, The Rape of Richard Beck, which was one of the rape dramas that actually dealt with a male character being raped. Wow. which by the way was Richard Crenna from Carl Troutman himself from the Rambo films.
Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah.
So that's kind of an interesting, I mean, I say infamous, but it was actually very well regarded. Richard Crenna won a, you know, Emmy for his performance. It's one of the few TV movies, and a lot of them dealt with rape situations, where it was, you know, male character suffering an assault, and of course Nicholas Wirth was one of the rapists.
well, good on him.
So you've earned your stripes, sir.
So overall, though, Hell Comes to Frogtown. we'll talk about that. It has an 88-minute running time, so it actually felt a lot longer than that, to be honest with you.
Films do feel long.
Yeah, so the thing with Hell Comes to Frogtown, it's got some good things going for it. Roddy Piper, the costumes and makeup, the voice work, but you know, it doesn't have, like you were saying, it doesn't have as many action scenes that maybe it should have, and this is the overall confusing message or theme. Yeah. So, I think Hell Comes to Frogtown, Joel. I'm not quite biting on it. I think in terms of a review on this one, I think I'm going to go, you know, thumbs down for Hell Comes to Frogtown. Reluctant thumbs down. I wanted to like it, but it just didn't have enough to bring it over the top for me.
Yeah, I mean, Japson, because of his style, he's a very languid filmmaker. It does feel longer than it is. I'm going to give a very mild recommendation, partly because Piper's great, partly because it's a film with good makeup, you know, a cast that's game and seems to be having a lot of fun with what they're doing and, like, gigs how ridiculous it is. And it's also, like, I always appreciate a film that's smart enough to know what its cast is good at, especially for a B-movie, because it uses Piper to full effect. You have Sandel Bergman, and you actually give her a dancing scene when she's a pro dancer. Like,
the dancing scene, yes.
Like, I mean, it's weird and insane, but, like, was smart enough to say, hey, we've got, yeah, everyone knows she's Valeria, but she danced with Bob Fosse. Why not give her something to do, like, regarding her expertise? Like, I appreciate that. Like, it's a film where, like, everyone is sort of, I mean, you know, there's, like, a lot of quasi-sexual tension with, like, Piper and Bergman. You know, yeah. They've got the sort of belligerent crush thing going on, and you know, they're a weirdly appealing screen couple because they're both sort of larger than life.
Yeah,
and I kind of wish the movie itself were larger than life, but it's a weird sort of clash to see these like people, these like incredibly talented like people with big presences and like this really sort of, I don't want to say shoddy, because the details of this are actually fairly well designed and thought out, but it's a shoddy world they're living in. So it's an interesting little take on the post-apocalyptic film. I mean, there's enough weirdness and interest here for me to give it a mild recommendation. I mean, if your choice is between watching this and rewatching They Live, like, rewatch They Live, but, like, if you're looking at the title and you just can't get past the idea of I have to watch Hell Comes to Frogtown, I just need to know, then, you know, I'm not gonna suggest not watching it, because yeah, it's called Hell Comes to Frogtown.
Right. It's Hell Comes to Frogtown. You know, lower your expectations and you'll probably be pleasantly surprised. This is Roddy Piper completists might enjoy this. You know, we have a lot of wrestling fans that listen to the show. There's a possibility that this is one Piper film that they haven't seen. Of course, not talking about some of the crap that he did in the mid-90s that went straight to video. But this predates They Live, so if you want to see Roddy Piper warming up for They Live, then check this movie out. Like I said, it does have a few good things going for it. Your mileage may vary, but mixed reviews on this one for us, and in terms of Donald Jackson himself, this is not really representative of his overall body of work for that we suggest that you do go and check out. As many Rollerblade 7 movies as you can.
As many as you can get through before you drop.
Exactly. So there you have it. So that's Donald Jackson and Hell Comes to Frogtown. Ooh, when we come back from break, we're going to talk about martial arts films and a prolific director in that genre, Mr. Chang Che, and his movie The Duel, or Duel of the Iron Fist. When we come back, We'll talk about it.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Churn world serves its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Feed it up an ox. Speak grunt. No strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Fight down. High choir and a fire. Representing seven games in a government for hire and a combat site. Let the West coming in a hurry with the Furies breathing down. My team reporters baffle Trump, Kevin Kraft. Look at that, no plane. Fine, then, uh-oh, overflow. Population common food, but it'll do. Save yourself, serve yourself. World serves its own needs. Listen to your heart, bleed. Dummy with the rapture and the reverend and the right. Right, you vitriolic, patriotic, slam, fight, bright, light, feeling, pretty sight.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com. And we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Just a year ago, on this very night, Can gave me money to arrange the death of old Mr. Shen.
Now you die!
welcome back to the second half of episode 30 of Go Home in a Box, where we're talking about a couple of cult film directors, or off the maybe not so mainstream directors here, but we talked about Donald Jackson in the first half and his movie Hell Comes to Frogtown. And here we are in the second half, and we're going to get down into some martial arts films here. We're going to talk Mr. Chang Che, the director of the film that we're going to speak on, The Duel, or the cooler title, Duel of the Iron Fist, from 1971. And let's talk about Chang Che for a few moments here, Joel, because this guy actually had quite the career. Director of such well-known martial arts films, probably some of the greatest martial arts films that people can recall, like The Five Deadly Venoms, The Brave Archer, and The One-Armed Swordsman.
Which I'm a particular fan of. And at the time, I believe it was the most successful domestic release in Hong Kong history. It's weird to be talking about Chang Che and, like, overlook directors because, you know, obviously in Hong Kong, he's an absolute legend.
Oh, yeah.
I guess in America, he is too among a certain segment of film fans, like big martial arts fans. I mean, he's a household name. Like someone like me is a household name, but, you know, to a more casual martial arts audience, you know, they probably know the actors much more than the directors. If the, you know, they'll know Bruce Lee or, you know, Gordon Liu or people like that. They might not know the actual directors, and Chang Che is possibly the greatest martial arts director of all time, if not, and a good contender for greatest action film director of all time. I mean, his stuff is just incredibly varied. Like, he got wilder as he went on, which is usually not the case with most people. I mean, his films get... he goes from, of course, being influenced by Kurosawa and Gosha and Sergio Leone and Sam Peckinpah. Like, you know, you can definitely see those influences in things like One-Armed Swordsman working pretty closely with his troupe of actors who were all, like, who were, you know, fight choreographers as well, and just coming up with the strangest things and strangest ideas. I mean, you get so many weird gimmicky things that, you know, still work, like, and work really well, like in things like House of Traps and Five Element Ninjas. I mean, these are extremely crazy, strange martial arts films that, like, you know, I think even people who are only familiar with the stereotypes of martial arts films would be able to watch this and be, like, surprised by how insane these movies are.
Yeah, I mean, we've got, and you mentioned that he, American audiences, he's, the martial arts film genre itself really, I don't think for the most part it rose above, you know, cult film status in most cases. But here we have Chang Che, who's referred to as, like you said, he's the godfather of Hong Kong cinema. So, I mean, he's a hero in China. He directed nearly 100 films, 100, for Shaw Brothers alone. And, you know, they ran the gamut from things like swordplay with, like, The One-Armed Swordsman, Golden Swallow, to straight-up kung fu films like Five Shaolin Masters, The Five Venoms, period dramas like Chinatown Kid, The Generation Gap, costume epics, Boxer Rebellion. I mean, this, yeah, like, he just ran the gamut here. He didn't just pigeonhole himself to one style of film here. So, this guy, just for the Shaw Brothers studio alone, 100 films, man, that's crazy.
I think there are days where I don't even take 100 steps. Like, I
yeah. So anyway, I mean, quite the prolific career. And as you mentioned, he's got influences from Kurosawa and Peckinpah and Leone and but he in turn has influenced many other directors in his own right. John Woo was a clear he was a clear influence on John Woo. Quentin Tarantino, he actually dedicated Kill Bill Volume 2 to Chang Che. Robert Rodriguez counts as he counts Chang Che as an influence as well.
Yeah, and of course Zhang Yimou, one of our greatest director modern directors. Like if you've seen Hero or House of Flying Daggers, like there's a clear through line back to Chang Che's period dramas and swordplay wuxia swordplay films. Like it's just like a straight line back to his work. Just really remarkable influence. I mean, and his films, like we'll talk about it a bit. I mean, regardless of the size, because he made films with smaller casts and a smaller world and films that were large pieces, but they're all beautifully shot. They're so vibrant. They're so colorful. I mean, even beyond just the energy of a martial arts film, they're so full of life, and the actors all have martial arts actors are very stagey in some ways. It's almost like watching a play. There's these big actors making big proclamations, but yeah. I always feel like Chang Che brings out the best in some of his actors, that like you get some more subtle performances out of them, which is something we'll be talking about in just a second with Duel of the Iron Fist, because like some of these characters are just phenomenal.
Yeah, as we delve into Duel of the Iron Fist here, that's one of the things that struck me about it. And I went on record here with you earlier while we were on break telling you that I'm okay with martial arts films, I'm not their biggest fan because, for the ones I've seen, I can't speak for all martial arts films. I mean, there's probably still some out there that'll probably blow me away, but a lot of the ones I've seen, like the fight scenes kind of tend to blend. There's so many fight scenes throughout some of these movies that they kind of tend to blend together, but the choreography is always on point. I mean, choreography in these films will always, just boggle your mind. How do they get the timing down and all that stuff? It's just great. And what stands out for Duel of the Iron Fist for me is, of course, the lushness, as you put it, the vibrance of the photography, the cinematography by Kung Muto. Very well done in this film. A very vibrant film, very lush and colorful, and just looks great. I mean, you don't even need to restore these films because they just look so, they just, on their own, they just look so, just off the color palette, really. There's just, everything just looks so good. So with Duel of the Iron Fist, we talk about that a little bit. Some of the characters in the film, and the cast, we'll start with Ti Lung as a Tang. Ti Lung, you can probably see him in some other films like The Avenging Eagle, The Sentimental Swordsman. He was even in John Woo's classic A Better Tomorrow. So Ti Lung heads the cast on this one. You got any thoughts on Ti Lung, Joel?
Oh yeah, Ti Lung is like a perfect like classic hero type in martial arts films. He's so good at playing the humble guy who's pushed to vengeance or pushed to rescue people. I mean, he's often in that kind of role, playing someone like Avenging Eagle, playing a character who's been raised basically crime family, and assassin family, really, and he's like finally realizing like how awful this is. I mean, he's the guy who's good at playing the fairly innocent hero who, like, even though he's capable of horrific violence, he's not going to use it until he has to. And it's a classic martial arts trope, and he's like one of the best at it.
Yeah. So we've got Tai Lung playing, and gosh, I always get the pronunciation wrong. His character was Tang Renjie, I guess.
I think so. I'm not great with pronunciation either. So
and
I can't pronounce most things in English, let alone Chinese.
And Ku Feng. Ku Feng. Where have you seen Ku Feng? Ku Feng is, of course, he's been in all kinds of Shaw Brothers stuff. He was in the new one-armed swordsman. Shaolin Temple, the Brave Archer. He was also
Mighty
in the
Peking Man. He was in Duel of Fists, or follow-up to this. I mean, not follow-up in terms of storyline, but follow-up in terms of bringing the cast and crew back together.
Yeah. So, we have two brothers here, Tang Renjie and Tang Renlin. And they are the adopted son and the henchman, respectively, of Triad leader Shen Tianheng. And Shen was involved in a battle against a rival Triad leader, Liu Shuyi, played by Ho Ban. These names. Where both of them were killed. So Jie then takes the initiative to be the scapegoat for the crimes of his brother Lin, and Gan Wenbin, played by Chun Yun. And he flees. At this point, Gan, sends people out to kill Jie. And he seizes all of Shen's properties and drives Lin away. And we have a guy who an adopted son here who took the fall for his adopted father's crimes and left the scene. Meanwhile, you got a guy taking over the Triad and trying to do everything he can to wipe everyone out that might oppose him and take over. And probably, Joel, the most interesting character in this movie is the Rambler, David.
Yes.
This guy's the movie stealer for me.
Oh my god, the Rambler is probably my favorite kung fu character of all time. I mean, David Chiang, I'm a big fan of him anyway. Like, he's a great actor. He's a great kung fu actor. He's like got such an aura of cool about him, and like, nowhere is that more prevalent than here, because unlike everyone who's dressed in typical martial arts gear, they've got the tunics and the baggy pants, like, and of course at one point Tai Lung has a chest tattoo, but which is awesome. But the Rambler, it's like early 1900s, turn of the century. He's dressed in a totally boss suit.
He wears a pinstripes. Suit. That's right.
At one point, I'm pretty convinced, they steal his outfit from the end of the movie for Han Solo's, because he's got the white shirt and black vest deal. I mean, just everything about him just absolutely, drips cool. It's for our, wrestling followers, remember the first time you saw Razor Ramon?
Yeah.
That's the first time you see the Rambler.
He's basically the epitome of cool, except for that nagging little cough that he has.
Yeah, he's got.
He's got
TB, and he's still kicking ass.
Yeah, he's got the smoker's lung, and he can still beat everybody.
And he's a wild card in this film. There's all sorts of rumors about him. He's not really part of this family. He's kind of a hired gun, and there's rumors that he's from the South, and he's part of. And he's working a government operative, or maybe he's working for the revolution.
So yeah, his character, there's quite a bit of mystery surrounding his character, because no one quite knows which side he's playing for.
One of the things about this film, and a lot of kung fu films, just to digress for a second, I mean, of course, going through the plot, you can see that it's a little bit convoluted. A lot of crime family dramas can be. There's a lot of deception, there's a lot of betrayal, and this of course has that element, but it's in a backdrop, as a lot of kung fu movies are, a lot of wuxia films, on, you know, moments in Chinese history, especially where there was a dynasty change or a regime change, some kind of social upheaval. I mean, this is more modern. It's around the 1910s, 1920s. So it's a little bit more. So it's a little bit more accessible if you don't really know much about Chinese history. And I'm not exactly an expert. There's probably an embarrassing amount of Chinese history I've learned through kung fu films.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's obviously, like, it's sort of against the backdrop of, you know, China becoming industrialized, China sort of moving towards, you know, and to empire and dynasty, and moving towards involvement with the Western world, you know, towards engagement with communism. Like, I mean, all that is in the background, so there's a sense that, like, these triad, like, wars are both because of that and almost, like, ignorant of that. Like, there's bigger upheavals even beyond that, and, you know, like, at the end, there's a big element where, like, guns show up for the first time, and everyone's sort of aghast that in their world, guns exist now.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is, this really, in terms of the violence throughout the film, so it's pretty, let's just say a lot of people die in this movie. There's a lot of bloodshed and violence, and which is typical for, you know, a Chang Che film. You know, but, you know, the final battle sequence, I think, really displays the movie's attempt at political commentary, as you were getting into there. You've got, like, a Tan, you know, like, vanquishing all of the evildoers he can find, but, you know, you got a senator who's been pulling the strings to avoid punishment and stuff like that. I mean, the final battle sequence in this film is really saying the most in terms of political commentary.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's when, like, all the themes in the film, all the stuff that's been sort of lurking at the edges of the film that the Rambler is sort of immersed in but sort of separate from, like, all that starts to impinge on the main narrative. Like, you know, and it's pitting that, like, heroic bloodshed mold where, like, you know, by this point, Tang and the Rambler, they're, you know, they're sort of linked together, total brothers, totally loyal.
Yeah.
Pitting that older heroic mode against this encroaching, industrialized, you know, sort of faceless new power that's come on the scene. You know, one that, you know, seems like it's, yeah, you know, it's very authoritarian. It has its own rules, and the rules are probably even stiffer than the triad sort of way of life. But at the same time, it's less complicated, but there's less to it at the same time. I mean, it says a lot in one fight scene that almost feels not quite separate from the main narrative, but like a totally new element that gets introduced at the end. It's a really sort of daring choice narratively.
Yeah, it is. And in terms of you know, action scenes, I mean, this movie is definitely filled to the brim with them. It just goes from one fight scene to the next.
And always more guys show up. When you think a fight scene's over, more guys crash through the window, and it's on again. It's amazing.
It is amazing. And generally, you know, for the most part, you've got, like, one or two guys, you know, taking on, like, dozens simultaneously. I mean, you've got more than one scene. I mean, Tang is quite capable of it's kind of like, it's kind of like, you know, they attack the gangs attack Tang or the Rambler ninja style, you know, one at a time. They're surrounding him, of course, but it's almost like, you know, bad ninjas, you know, where Tang is able to easily dispatch all of them. But, I mean, like I was saying earlier, the fight choreography is just, you know, beyond mind-boggling on this, because you have so much going on, just with so many arms and legs and swords coming at you, and the timing of everything is just pitch perfect. And I mean, that just, and that's one thing that I've always marveled about on martial arts films, is just the timing of everything. It's almost like, you know, hey, it's done in one take. You know, it looks like it's done in one take, and it just looks great, you know.
Oh yeah, it's so fluid. Like, and you know, for, like you said, for as many people are as involved in these fight scenes, and there are a lot of people, like there, you know, dozens of people in some of these scenes.
Yeah.
And you know, different fights happening all over, like within the same building. And you know, this is not like, this is also like a wuxia film. This is a weapons based film, so you're typically, you're seeing more sword play, and they're not even like, it's not even sword play in the way I think a lot of people casual to kung fu films, to martial arts films, would think of it, like in the more sort of one-armed swordsman or, you know, Kurosawa samurai vein. Like, I mean, these guys are using like these vicious cleaver broadsword things.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they're, and the, like the Rambler's just going around sort of like bored and casually stabbing people. That's the thing. Like, one of the reasons Chang Che's films are so good is the actors are so good at conveying personality in the fight scenes. And yeah, this is like, this is one of the greatest martial arts movies ever for that. Like, it, like, just the contrast between the way, like, T Lung fights in this and the way David Chiang does, it's just phenomenal.
Yeah. And so, if I'm to sum up this film here, Joel, well, let me ask you first. Do you have anything else to add about Duel of the Iron Fist before we sum up our thoughts on it?
It's a dangerous question because I could go on for hours about this goddamn movie, but no, it's just, you know, unfortunately, I've never gotten to see this on the big screen. I'm not sure if there's an English subtitled or dub print out there, but I've seen trailers for it on 35mm, and even the trailers feel larger than life. It's just, you know, for as complicated as the plot can be sometimes, because there's a lot of, like, actors involved, like, in terms of, there's a lot of figureheads, like, all sort of grappling with each other for power, and you don't necessarily need to understand it perfectly the first time through, because you're kind of in Tang's place where you're just sort of being pushed from one power to another until you figure out that you're being manipulated.
Yeah.
So it does. So it puts you in his place. So if you go into this and you're sort of new to martial arts films, or, you know, less familiar with them, and you feel a bit confused early on by the plot, it's totally normal, because it is a complicated betrayal-filled, like, plot, at least early on.
Yeah.
You know, that, which is sort of the, one of the very, one of the really attractive things about the heroic bloodshed mold is that, you know, the idea that, well, all these, like, fat and contented gang leaders are grappling for power, all these corrupt politicians grappling for power, a couple guys with enough willpower and training can just, like, put an end to it through kicking enough ass to stop it. Like, it's a nice dream. It's one, yeah. Like, I mean, it's probably at the heart of a lot of action films across a lot of cultures, but, you know, I think in the duel, especially because it does have kind of a downer ending, it's both showing why that's attractive and deconstructing it a little.
Yeah. Yeah, good thoughts on that, exactly. So, in summing up this film, I enjoyed it. I did enjoy it. I enjoyed the, like I was mentioning earlier, the lush photography, the very, very colorful, vibrant scenery and costumes just jumping off the screen at you. And Chang Che and his cinematographer, you know, really showing their craft in this one, I think. And of course, you know, plenty of action, plenty of martial arts action. So it never really bores. And of course, And I think you're in agreement here, Joel. I think David Chang stealing the movie as the Rambler. I think this is probably, in terms of martial arts films anyway, probably one of the greatest martial arts characters in the genre.
Oh, easily. I mean, if you're not sold on martial arts films, like, even after this, you'll probably be sold on that character because he's just, like I said, just absolute pure coolness.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I guess, Joe, do you have any final summarizing thoughts on Duel of the Iron Fist?
See, you're asking again. It's dangerous. It's just a bunch of people at the absolute height of their craft just putting together, like, you know, a surprisingly layered film that still also functions as, you know, a complete adrenaline rush film. It's just a wonderful example of, like, what martial arts cinema can be.
All right. Two rousing reviews for The Duel, a.k.a. Duel of the Iron Fist, from acclaimed martial arts film director Chang Che. Very good, Joel. I think we'll move on here towards our closing segment. I think we got a bit of a rant here. And
that's new for us.
I guess what we want to talk about is, well, at this point, you know, a lot of people, you know, have gone out and seen Star Wars The Last Jedi. But just days or hours before it was released, You wouldn't be too lost if you went on social media, via Twitter, Facebook, whatever the case is, and you know, saw maybe some complaints from people who are shunning spoiler attempts. You know, with statements like, "All right, going to see Star Wars: The Last Jedi. No spoilers, please." Or things of that nature, or I'm shutting down social media for 2 days so The Last Jedi doesn't get ruined for me. And so, I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's just, you know, people don't like to have movies ruined for them, and that's understandable. Myself, personally, Joel, I'll go on Wikipedia the day the movie's released, or maybe the day after, and I'll go read the plot synopsis. I am not ashamed to say that. I spoil movies for myself all the time. You know, especially since the Marvel movies have the post-credits scenes, mid-credits scenes, you know, whatever you want to call them. I was always interested in those. Give me one.
Oh, hold on. So, I'm recording my podcast.
Oh, okay, sorry.
We've only got, like, probably 15, 20 minutes left. What's up?
I was going to put the furniture on this side of the attic. I kicked a box out of the way, and a little bat scrunched up.
Aw.
Now Dave can't find it. So it wasn't dead. Maybe it went under the box again.
So.
Hey, sorry about that.
Hey, no problem.
I'm back at home with parents.
Yeah, like, my voice was cracking. I had to stop and get a drink of water anyway. I was about to lose my voice there before your mom came in. So, yeah, I'll edit all that out. What was I talking about? Oh, yeah, about going on Wikipedia and spoiling movies for myself. So let me pick it back up. Yeah, so you know, Marvel movies and their post-credits stuff just really piqued my interest, and that's why I started going on Wikipedia to spoil movies for myself. I have no problem with it. I mean, sure, I know it's going to happen, but it's still the whole experience of watching it unfold on screen. You could read about it, but then visualizing how it comes out is another thing entirely. But that's just me. I don't really care if someone spoils a movie for me. I'm fine with that. But, you know, there are some people who sound like they're going to resort to violence, you know, if someone tries to spoil a movie for them. And, you know, yeah, it just get a little ridiculous with the attempts, you know, to try and go spoiler free. I mean, probably not spending so much time on social media is a good thing anyway, but to make that public declaration to not spoil a movie for you, I think it gets a little out of hand sometimes.
Yeah, you know, I actually prefer the people who just say I'm going off social media till I see it, because at least, like, if you're taking it into your own hands, all right, awesome. But, like, the people who, like, start making rules about how you are supposed to interact about on social media, how, like, when you can talk about a movie, like, it just, you know, it feels very privileged white guy for me to be saying, don't tell me how to talk. But, but it's just, it's movies, you know? Like,
yeah.
Here's the thing. Typically, I'll avoid spoilers for a movie I want to see. If I'm going on Wikipedia to read the plot, it's mostly because it's just another Marvel movie I'm not going to bother seeing. I just want to see if anything happens where there's a discussion I might want to be a part of. Like, or at least be familiar with the discussion that's going to be taking place on social media.
Yeah.
So like, I'll try to avoid, like, I guess spoilers, but I'm not really concerned, because if a movie's only ability is how to surprise, how it surprises you, like, with like a twist, then there's there's nothing worthwhile about that movie. I mean, like, you know, if like we're talking episodes of an anthology TV series like The Twilight Zone or like a horror short story, a sci-fi short story with a twist at the end,
yeah,
all right, awesome. Or, you know, even some like classic twists, like say Planet of the Apes, like that's a bit where, you know, the twist is valuable thematically in addition to being a surprise. Like, those are worthwhile, but if the whole point is, like, you're following, like, some franchise and it's like, don't tell me the spoilers, I know someone's gonna die, I don't want to know beforehand, like, then what you're doing is soap opera watching. And that goes for TV, too, like Game of Thrones and Walking Dead and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there's not a reasonable level of quality to something like Game of Thrones, but fundamentally, these narratives function like soap operas. Like, ongoing narratives, serialized narratives tend to, because at a certain point, the theme gets lost, or the urgency, the spark that, like, made the narrative valuable or vital, like, gets lost through repetition or just length of the narrative. Like, it's why I tend to prefer movies to serialized drama TV shows.
Yeah.
You know, why I'll always take, like, you know, an Ozu film over Breaking Bad. Because even if there's a reasonable level of quality to the latter, like, the sort of ongoing nature of it, I think, is a limitation. And movies have been made with that in mind lately. Like, I don't think, and one of the things that I found interesting about The Last Jedi, not to go too deep into it and derail the point of the discussion, was that it seemed to be a movie partly about turning over those expectations,
right?
Which, and being a film where, like, people were complaining later on, and we could talk about this more some other week, like, in terms of people's expectations versus how a movie turns out. But people were complaining that, like, the narrative didn't feel tight, and plot-wise, they weren't, that's not inaccurate, but thematically and character, in terms of character building, like, everything went together really well. And I thought that was interesting, because people are so in tune with plot, with narrative and plot now, but not with themes or characters anymore. And I think that's like, I'm not saying that, like, all viewers are, you know, mindless sheeple or whatever, you know, so whatever some tough guy caustic critic would say, but I'm saying that, like, the popular things among nerd culture now, which is of course pretty much mainstream culture at this point, are all sort of serialized and plot driven. And to me, you know, you don't see people getting pissed off that, like, someone spoiled Lady Bird,
for them, or The Shape of Water. quality films that are made to be, like, you know, intelligent multi-layered stories.
Yeah.
Like, I love, hey, I read tons of superhero comics, but the Marvel films are not that interesting. Like, right. And they get less interesting with each passing film, which is why people are seem most interested in the what happens next. I mean, how many people do you really know, like, rewatch Game of Thrones? Because the interest is what happens next. I mean, whenever that's the case, it just absolutely turns me off. Like, I have no interest in a narrative that's just what happens next. I love stuff that I can savor and revisit, and stuff where there's so many layers that that you can delve deeper into. There's facets that become more apparent on future notes. Like, rewatching Get Out the other day, it struck me as so obvious that, and killed me that I had never seen this before, that, spoiler alert, friends, at the, like, when he's, about to undergo the procedure, when he, you know, digs the cotton out of the chair to stuff his ears, he is literally picking cotton to save himself, and that totally went over my head the first time I had seen it.
Oh, man.
Like, that's thoughtful imagery like that, like, that serves the theme and narrative of a story. That stuff really yeah. fascinates and engages me. So, like, and I thought there was actually a lot of that in the new Star Wars, and less so in, say, the Marvel movies, or obviously Walking Dead, or even, you know, even though I would put it above a lot of that stuff, Game of Thrones. Like, there's a certain limit to what's available as, like, a narrative resource.
Right, exactly. And you made some very strong points, Joel. I mean, just basically, you know, the whole deal is, a lot of people's, I'm of the opinion that if there's, like, a twist in a film, you know, like a single solitary plot twist towards the end of the film, I'm under the assumption that particular incident sways whether someone enjoys a movie or not, you know? And that's why I spoil it for myself, because I know it's coming, and when it comes, you know, my opinion of the film, whether it's positive or negative, is not swayed by that incident. My opinion of the film is on the whole picture. And so a lot of people will think a movie is great because a certain, you know, plot twist was revealed. By the same token, some people think a movie is bad because the plot twist went, you know, they deemed it in a negative fashion. But, and then they'll remark on that aspect on social media saying, you know, such and such movie sucked because this happened. You know, but what about the rest of the movie? I mean, there's a beginning, there's a middle, and then there's an end. What about the bigger picture? You know, and so, you know, opinions can be swayed by these plot twists or character twists that they don't want revealed ahead of time. And I just think that's movie watching in general has changed. Not necessarily for the better, you know, and it's like we've been discussing this whole time. It's just the consumption of movies, how we watch them, has really changed. And I just think that, you know, so if someone reveals a plot point to you before you've seen the movie, don't get pissed off about it. Still go see the movie because you've been wanting to see it. Why the fuck would you, you know, why would your experience be ruined because someone gave away a certain plot point?
Yeah, I think binge-watching culture and fan culture have really damaged, like, the way we watch and interpret and evaluate movies. I don't think it's done a lot for the quality of films. I think it's just made everything sort of
digestible in a way that's not really rewarding to me. Yeah, I think the best thing I've ever seen someone say about the spoiler issue was asking Star Wars fans, so of all the countless hours you spent watching and obsessing over those films, the only valuable part to you was the Luke, I am your father reveal? Because it's true. I mean, if you had gone into Empire Strikes Back and the only thing you gained from that was, wow, Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's father, like,
yeah.
And even not particularly being a big Star Wars fan, like, it's, there's obviously much more to Empire Strikes Back than that moment.
Absolutely there is. So I guess that's our rant for this show. I mean, you know, spoilers. What's the big deal? What's the deal with spoilers?
Deal with the nerds.
As Jerry Seinfeld would put it, yeah. So, that was a good show, Joe. Good comeback for us after a few weeks off. And glad you're back in it, man. You're on top of your game. You know, you hadn't lost a step, man.
I try.
And that's it for this edition. Episode 30 is in the books.
Oh, my God, already?
Already, man. And we'll be looking forward to episode 31 here very soon. For Joel LaPuma, the Ayatollah of Pop Cultura, I am Chris Jordan. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time.